Today, we continue our series on addiction with a look at teens trapped by substance abuse. While some kids are thinking about grades, prom, or college, others worry about how to get their next drink or next fix. The nonprofit Partnership for a Drug-Free America says that by the eighth grade, 52% of adolescents have drunk alcohol, 41% have smoked cigarettes, and 20% have used marijuana. So how do kids even get drugs and alcohol, and when does experimentation turn into full-blown addiction? In a minute, we'll talk to an addiction specialist who is also a recovering addict. He's been sober for 36 years. But right now, we're joined by Lana, a recovering alcoholic who received treatment and now volunteers at Visions Adolescent Drug Abuse Treatment in Malibu, California. She is 16 years old and has been clean and sober for 2 years. Hi, Lana.
Hi.
So glad you guys are with us here at NPR West. So glad to see you and glad things are unfolding well for you, but sounds like they weren't always. Take me back to a moment where you felt that you were out of control.
Well, as they say, it's a disease of perception, so I'm never sure how out of control it was because I was a blackout drinker. And so the using period of my life is very blurry. And therefore, I'm not sure what it was, how to understand it. All I know is what they say is that it's incomprehensible demoralization.
When you talk about being a blackout drinker, I assume that you mean that literally, that you would drink till you passed out?
Yes, exactly. It's the lack of moderation. I'm a very black and white person. It's either all or nothing.
Well, let me help with that a little bit, if I could.
Because, well, please, go ahead.
Because, see, what a blackout is, it's not that somebody passes out. What happens is that somebody's functioning, but they don't remember what they're doing.
All right. I do have to say that we're just hearing from Alan Berger also in the studio. He's an addiction specialist. He also wrote the book 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, Avoiding Relapse Through Self-Awareness and Right Action. So before we get to you, though, I do want to get a little more of Lana's story so that people can understand the context of where she's coming from. But, you know, how old were you, do you think, when you first had a drink?
Well, I mean, growing up in Los Angeles, I've had drinks my entire life, but I think my first drunk was around 10, I think.
First moment where you felt like you were really drunk?
Yes.
And exactly. Was that in a social context or alone?
God, I think it was alone.
So you had access, I'm assuming, in your family's house?
Yes. It's great. My mother's right over there to hear this, too.
So, do you think that people in your life at the time knew that you were drinking as young as 10, or were you sneaking?
No.
No?
They didn't know? No, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Did they find out at a certain point?
I think my parents were in denial for a while, and then eventually as things unfolded and I became just very messy and distraught, they caught on.
How did you feel when you were essentially uncovered? Did you feel angry, betrayed? Did you feel like, this is no big deal? What's the big deal?
I felt angry, betrayed, all of that. I think the seven stages of grief really worked, like, the recovery. There's acceptance. There's, you know, anger. Well, it starts out with anger, and then there's bargaining and denial, and eventually there's acceptance.
Ellen, let's go to your story. You know, you're an addiction specialist, you're a book author, but you also are someone who started drinking around Lana's age.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Huh? How did that unfold for you?
Well, for me, it started after losing my father. My dad died of multiple myeloma, and he was just very, very important in my life. And there was just a tremendous amount of pain that I was experiencing over that, and I had no way to really talk about that. You know, in my family, when I was growing up, we just didn't talk about those things. We didn't sit around and share our grief and talk about the loss. And now, as I look back, all of those feelings just imploded. And about 3-4 months after his death, I drank. And I just remember the feeling I had. I mean, there was something that came over me. I had a friend say one time, he says, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but the minute I had that first drink, an alcoholic was born. And that's what happened for me. That's exactly what I experienced.
So we're talking 11, 12, et cetera, years old. Who noticed for you?
Well, it's very interesting because in our society there's such a high tolerance of for drinking and that thing. People really don't notice it. It's shocking, isn't it, when you hear her story or mine? Because I was a blackout drinker too. I mean, I'd come home and I wouldn't even know how I got home. I mean, I was functioning and doing all those things, but in a blackout, you function, but you have no memory of it. Mm. So that was going on. And my mother, I think in my family, part of it is she was so overwhelmed with her grief that's all that she was really addressing in her life. And she lost an awareness of what was going on with the rest of the children in the family and lost an awareness of me.
So when was the moment when you decided, I mean, because 36 years of sobriety is pretty phenomenal. When was the moment you decided this is enough and then made it happen?
I came back from Vietnam. I volunteered to go in the Marine Corps because at 16 years old, they asked me to leave high school. I wasn't going to classes. I was just out drinking and partying every day. 17, I joined. I had to get my mom's signature to go in. She was glad that I was going. Came back from Vietnam. I volunteered for Vietnam at 18, came back at 19 years old, right? At that point in time, not only was I drinking, but I was using other drugs. And my experience is the other drugs really accelerated the progression of my problem. It became much worse. I really, really, really lived to use and used to live kind of a thing. It came to that point. Well, I came back from Vietnam. I was on my way to Hawaii, which was going to be my last year in the Marine Corps. And on the way over, I got busted getting on the plane with a bunch of drugs. And so they told me they were going to turn me in to the commanding officer at the Marine station, which meant I was going to be thrown in the brig. I didn't want that. So when I got there, I turned myself in and I said I needed help. Really, what I was trying to do was manipulate so I wouldn't get thrown in brig, right? Well, what turned out, and this saved my life, I'm forever grateful, is that 3 days before I turned myself in, the Marine Corps started what they called a drug exemption program. Instead of throwing us in prison, in the brig, what they did is they got us help. And so I was a third Marine admitted into that program, and something happened in there. You know, I met someone who was in his recovery. In fact, I'm going to go celebrate his 40 years sober in Hawaii around Christmas this year. And he carried a message to me. And I saw a man that was talking about himself with a freedom that blew my mind. I mean, it was unbelievable the kind of personal freedom he had. The only time I felt that was when I was high. When I was drinking or using other drugs. So that's when it happened for me. And that was in 1971 on the beautiful island of Oahu.
Wow. Lana, when you hear a story like this, I wonder if it gives you some hope that you too could have sobriety that lasts for many years. But are you afraid ever? Are you afraid that this is something that you'll lose, that this focus on being healthy is something you'll lose?
Yeah, it's a scary feeling because sometimes the obsession's not relieved and the urge to use comes back to me, and that is terrifying. But it is so inspiring to hear someone who's been sober for various decades. I mean, that's huge, and it helps me with my life. If they can do it, I can do it too.
What does recovery mean for you? I mean, what do you actually do? Do you go to meetings? Now you're also a volunteer, but what does recovery mean for you in terms of what you do on the day-to-day, the week-to-week?
You know, I go to meetings at least 7 a week. I'm involved with the people. I'm involved with the community. I have to make a 12-step program part of my life in order to stay sober.
And what does it mean to reach out to other people?
Well, reaching out could be as far as taking someone out to coffee who's new to the program to, you know, volunteering. I volunteer tutor and give back to that community.
It sounds like this is something, Alan, that's working really well for Lana. But what kinds of things, from your perspective as someone who has dealt with recovery, from the aspect of an expert who helps other people, who writes about this, what are some things that teens face in particular that maybe people who are older and in recovery don't?
That's a great question, Kenya. I think the first thing is, the first real issue is that there's an incredible amount of peer pressure for someone like Lana. I was talking to her before we came on the show and says, you know, what happened, you know, after you got sober with your friends, and how did you deal with all of that? Because what takes place is that we must make a commitment to a new way of life for this to work. People that don't make that commitment with as much zeal and enthusiasm as they did when they were going out and they were drinking or using aren't going to get well. I mean, we have to at least match it. I think we've got to go beyond that, but at least match it. And sometimes that means that you're no longer with those friends, that you have to say goodbye. And that's a difficult decision to make because they're buddies, you know. You've done a lot of things with them. So that's a big thing that I would say.
Lana, we're going to, in a second, take a break. But before, just give me a sense of, you know, how do people perceive you who are not in recovery? I mean, do you ever worry about how your interactions unfold with other people who you were friends with in the past?
I don't really associate with anyone who I was friends with in the past. But my current peers, because I go to a regular school, at first were just so overwhelmed by my experience. I don't think, you know, normal people who aren't alcoholics can really fathom an alcoholic's experience and what they do and what they have done. And so I slightly ostracized because no one could truly understand it. But as people get to know me, they realize I'm not that scary.
Well, on that note, hold tight for a second. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. We're talking about teens and recovery. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are continuing our conversation on teens, addiction, and recovery with author and addiction specialist Alan Berger and Lana, who is a recovering alcoholic. So thanks for sticking with us. And I want to broaden this out a little bit, Alan. We've been talking mainly about alcohol because that was the drug that both of you used. But in general, what other addictions do teens possibly face?
Well, that's a great question because it's really the whole gamut of drugs that are out there. What we see right now is there's an incredible increase of the use of crystal meth. I mean, that is just an epidemic problem right now in the United States. So that's a really, really popular drug, the crystal meth. There's still a lot of crack cocaine out on the streets, cocaine. People are using that. Believe it or not, heroin has come back. And especially some of the opiates like OxyContin, which are really, really popular now. So those are the things. Marijuana is still up there. You know, even with Lana's story, as we heard, it wasn't just alcohol that she was using. She was drinking alcohol, but before we came on the show, she was telling me about the marijuana that she smoked. And that was true for me. It's like today there's rarely a person that's just, let's say, drinking alcohol. We're typically using a whole spectrum of different drugs.
Lana, how easy is it for people who are your age, in your experience, and everyone's experience is different, to access whether it's marijuana or perhaps some of the harder drugs?
It is way too easy for adolescents to access any kind of narcotic. You can find it anywhere. You can turn the wrong corner and come across a dealer. So you can find drugs in treatment. I mean, it's pretty easy to get high.
So it sounds like your discipline then has to be that much stronger.
Exactly.
What do you tell people, Alan, when, you know, they're faced with the reality that in many situations, and as Lana argues, even in recovery, you might be able to get your hands on something that has been your bane in the past?
Yeah, well, that's a good point because, see, we cannot insulate someone. You know, drugs, the use of drugs in this society, it's omnipresent. So what the issue becomes one of is what is one's commitment to recovery? And that is learning to say no. And what was that big campaign? Just say no. I mean, that really, that's apropos here.
Do you really believe that? And what I mean is, do you really believe it's as simple as saying no? What can you do to get people to know or to help people get to know?
Well, that's a good question, right? Because what it comes down to, recovery is about this moment. You know, I asked Lana, well, what's the most important thing or most challenging thing in your recovery today? You know what she said, and it was really very insightful on her part. She says, it's staying in the now. So right now is when I have my commitment to my recovery. So if I get approached, I need to check in with what my commitment is right now. A lot of people have to turn to their higher power to ask for help at that point in time, because what we know is just based on our own resources, meaning alone I can't deal with this. But with your help, with the help of counselors, with the help of a higher power, a God of our understanding, we can go ahead and tackle this problem.
Juana, we just did something on spirituality and recovery. When you get to a point where you think, I'm challenged, what or who do you turn to?
Are you asking if I have a higher power?
It can be, I'm talking about higher power, friends, family. I mean, who's there in your corner?
I turn to my sponsor. I turn to my friends. I have a very, rational idea of a higher power. It's I'm powerless, therefore there's something more powerful than myself. I'm not a big fan of God or any of that. That's just my personal choice.
Sounds like you've got a lot of backup in your life among people who you trust.
Yes, but it's taken a while to build that.
I was going to ask, do you think that you would have trusted people like this before when you were drinking and getting high?
No, there is no trust when you're using.
Well, I really appreciate both of you sharing your stories and your journey. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were talking with Lana, a recovering alcoholic who received treatment and now volunteers at Visions Adolescent Drug Abuse Treatment in Malibu, California. Also with Alan Berger, the author of 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, Avoiding Relapse Through Self-Awareness and Right Action. They both joined us here at our NPR West studios.